It's a great pleasure to be here. It's very nice to come to California in winter from Chicago. And I thanks Terry Hua for arranging my trip. Also, this is my first time in this campus. Actually, I passed by and never came in. So it's very enjoyable. I'm going to cover two topics, okay? And I have to say I prepare these slides well prepared for biologists. And the two talks actually were given in half an hour in a symposium. So you can see how we biologists talk about things. It's very, very brief. I assume that everyone has the background. But today, I like to make it informal and stop me anytime because I don't know how much you know about biology and how much should I go into. But you know, I'll raise questions anytime, okay? And I'll go slowly. The first one is, the second one is mainly biological, not much mathematics. The first one involves some parts involve some mathematics and statistics. And the work was done mainly by my student, Zhengdong Gu. And then Nicolae is a statistician in the Department of Statistics at the University of Chicago. And Henry Lu is my friend. He's a statistician from Taiwan. And they collaborate with us in analyzing the data. Okay. And the topic is expression divergence between duplicate genes. This is an older issue. It's an issue maybe for 80 years or more, okay? And why gene duplication is an important topic in biology? It's a very essential topic in biology. Why? Because duplication provides the freedom, the actual copy, to do something else. Imagine if there's no duplication, a bacterium will always be a bacterium. Not maybe some a little bit different, but not very different from bacterium, okay? Because it cannot do anything extra, okay? And so duplication, okay. Yeah. What I mean duplication includes not only whole gene duplication, it includes also partial gene duplication. So suppose you have no gene duplication and you have a gene on limit length, how many domains can you put in? Limit, okay? So you may have a gene with two functions, three functions, all functions. How many more will you add on? So if a bacterium has, let's say, 400 genes, if you multiply each gene by four functions, how much? 1600 functions, right? So it's limited, okay? It cannot go very far, okay? And when I say redundancy, duplication, it includes you import something from outside, okay? So the organism originally doesn't have this gene, and you may have a horizontal transfer from another species. It's doing something else. But that's, again, that introduces a redundancy, okay? So the topic here is that the point here is that if you don't have a redundancy, you cannot do much extra, okay? Your freedom is limited, okay?
Are you talking mainly about bacteria?
I'm talking about why duplication is important. And
can I just make a point?
Okay.
Because of sex,
okay,
you have two copies of the gene anyhow.
That's fine. That's only double the number.
Well, but you doubled them, so you've got the freedom to do. You've got the freedom.
No, because the locus, that's only the limit of function. The same locus cannot diverge. The two genes at the same locus cannot diverge. They are defined by the function. Okay, they segregate. Okay, it cannot do different things. It may be a multifunctional gene, but it cannot do something else. Okay. I already say insertion is you introduce something extra. You introduce a redundancy. Extra.
But that's redundancy. Redundancy means a function which is equivalent to the organism. And this thing is a redundancy.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sure. But by that you increase the main point. Maybe I should not say main point redundancy. I should say if you don't have increase in genetic material, you have no freedom to do other things.
But I guess the reason I'm challenging this is that the argument has been made in many important points of evolution where developmental requirements have increased, not necessarily primarily as a result of gene duplication, but actually the invention of new growth channels, like the immunoglobulin involved.
Yeah. It might be. But
I'm interested in, as opposed to this being a verbal assertion, is there evidence of is there any way of parsing out the relative contributions of evolution and development of duplication conversions of existing genes versus the invention of new genes?
Sorry, and there's a third one, and that is opening up, changing the control side. Yeah.
If you have a same gene, changing the control site doesn't help much, because you just change the site of expression or tissue expression or time of expression. It increase your diversity, but it doesn't give you the chance to do something new, something else.
This is not the moment to talk about Hox genes, but the way Hox genes work, the Hemiovox genes work, it's the downstream targets that matter. All the changes is where those Hox gene proteins actually bind.
I agree, okay. Let's say, for example, we work on PAX6, we work on PAX genes, and all the PAX genes, my view of the PAX genes is that originally PAX genes may be a regular transcription factor, a regular gene, it may be doing something else, and its function was increased, so it later was recruited to regulate eye development or central nervous development, okay? But look, Hox genes have been duplicated many, many times. PAX genes have been duplicated many, many times. Huh? Oh, we have something like 39 Hox genes in our body, and it's clustered into four clusters, so that's four duplications, and all the Hox genes in a cluster, 13 genes in a cluster, that many of them are duplicated. Right? Okay, so if we talk about the increase of body plane diversity, it's duplication, right? What else?
Downstream targets.
But duplication, it allows you to do something else. I mean, the yeah, I don't know it's the only thing, okay. But let's focus the importance of duplication, okay? So duplication it gives you the freedom to do something extra, to do something else, okay? But in order for duplications to do something else, it requires divergence, okay? And in the beginning, when a duplication occurs, the two genes are identical in function. Okay, and so if it's a redundant, copy is facing the challenge of deleterious mutation. And once deleterious mutation occurs, then it may become non-functional. Okay. So in fact, the common view about the fate of duplication is that it's doomed. It's most of the cases it becomes a pseudogene. Okay. So for to maintain a duplicate gene, an actual copy, sometimes it requires the first thing maybe it increases the dosage, so it does give something extra. Okay. And then after that, or something that it diverges in regulation, so it may allow the genes to do refinement of the function, do something else. Okay. So for example, here I'll give you an example. Okay. So in the 1960s, people studied duplicate genes. And the enzymes encoded by duplicate genes are called isozymes. And isozymes, the one thing that people say, isozymes increase the complexity of an organism because it allows you to allow the genes to specialize in different tissues.
Excuse me, I thought that isozymes, they have the same function.
See, it can be the same function, but may do it better. And I'm going to give you an example, okay? So, for example, Clement Markert worked on lactate dehydrogenase genes, okay? And there are three kinds of lactate dehydrogenase genes called A, B, C. C is expressed in the testes. A and B are expressed in different organs, okay? I don't remember all the detail, but like I say, that A may function better in aerobic condition, and that B may function better in anaerobic condition. So that A may be more suitable for function in the lung, in the liver, and that B may work better in the muscle. So when you do exercise, you exhaust the oxygen. Okay, so it may become a little bit anaerobic. So by that you can see that the duplicate genes allows you to do functions, specialize in function. So it does better. Okay.
But the statement is that isozymes are actually homologous.
Yes.
Rather than convergent. So and this is true for all isozymes, most isozymes, some isozymes.
By definition, isozymes are encoded by duplicate genes at different loci. Okay, so that's a definition of isozyme. They are not called isozymes. Okay, so the isozymes means that the distinguishing between isozyme and allozyme. Allozyme means that you are the same locus, different alleles. Okay, so maybe you have, like say, in a case of like say hemoglobin, beta, you have a hemoglobin S, okay, which may function better in because it is cause anemia, and it may function at the place where malaria it provides some resistance to malaria infection because it doesn't survive well in a low oxygen case. Okay, so at the same locus, you call that allozyme, and duplicate loci, you call that isozymes. Okay, so isozymes by definition are from duplicate genes, and you are saying that they are doing the same function. And I give you another example. So, for example, myoglobin and hemoglobin came from the same origin. Okay, and hemoglobin functions better in the bloodstream. It carries oxygen in the bloodstream, And then it carries oxygen to the tissue. And then the myoglobin takes over the oxygen to deliver to tissues. Okay. And that's another example of the function of duplicate genes. Okay. So how it may improve the function of an organism. Okay. And as I say, duplicate genes to survive, sooner or later, it has to do something good, do something extra, okay? And the traditional view is to say, okay, maybe the first step of gene duplication survival is to have differentiation in regulation of the two copies so they can specialize in different tissues. And a traditional way to study this is by protein electrophoresis, okay? And Ono, before Ono, there were already recognition about the importance of gene duplication. But Ono was the one to popularize, to emphasize, to call the attention of the biologists to the importance of gene duplication. And so he wrote a book, Evolution by Gene Duplication, okay? And so his main point is without gene duplication, organisms cannot evolve very far, okay? And by the way, when he wrote this book, his book was reviewed and was severely criticized, okay? Saying that this is wrong, something junk, okay? But later on, he was recognized to be someone very innovative, very, very insightful, okay? So he became a big name. So his view is that gene duplication is the most important mechanism for genetic novelty, okay? And before him, the view was that natural selection is very important. Natural selection was the major thing that contribute to diversity or different things. Okay, Ono say, no, natural selection is a policeman. Okay, it watches you. If you do something not according to the rule, it gives you punishment. Okay. So it doesn't allow you freedom, okay? And the only thing to escape natural selection is you have something extra, okay? And gene duplication is the way for you to escape the policeman, watching you and doing something not according to the rule. Okay, that's his view, and I think that is well accepted among biologists. Maybe some people would disagree, but I think, in my personal view, I still think that duplication is very important. You talk about Hox genes, duplication is important. You talk about Pax genes, duplication is important. You talk about actin, duplication is important. So you talk about everything we know function. Although the immunology, immunoglobulins may be originally from transposable elements, but you see, without duplication, you cannot have a diversity. You cannot face so many invasions. Okay, so the key of immunology is diversity. Generate millions of antibodies, different kinds of antibodies. And that's duplication and recombination, okay? Enable you to generate different kinds of things. So that's about the importance of duplicate genes. And so his view is that, okay, in order to retain duplicate genes, maybe the first step is for functional the major mechanism for maintaining duplicate gene is expression divergence. And after that, you may have a functional specialization, allow you to do things in different tissues. But this so far, no one to my knowledge, no one have been able to ask such a answer this question. How often and how fast do duplicate genes diverge in expression? Okay. That because in the past there was no suitable data. So for example, as I mentioned in the 1960s, in the 1970s, Clement Markert studied isozymes. He spent all his life, all what he did was study lactate dehydrogenases. Okay, that took his whole life. Okay, and he became very famous for that. Okay, but you can imagine that if you use the traditional method to study duplicate gene in that way, you cannot go very far. It just takes too much time. And now with the new technology, microarray gene expression, and to do that, of course, you need the whole genome sequencing. Why? Because if you don't know the genes, you don't have the genes, you cannot do it on the microarray. You don't know what to put on the microarray, okay? So you know the genome, and you put the genes on the microarray, and so that you can express them, and then you can measure the relative level of expression, okay? And so by this, you may be able to see a general picture of the two questions I raised, how often and how fast, okay? And still, up to now, there are not many organisms that do that. One is that the East genome, and the other, we recently did a study on humans, okay? And beyond that, maybe Arabidopsis or C. elegans, you may do something, which was C. elegans, and it's the data were not very good. But because of that, we asked the original data from the authors, and there was no response. They did not want to give us the original data. Okay. So the question is that after gene duplication, then you have a sequence divergence. Okay, and the question is, remember that in evolution, the most difficult thing is that we don't know time. We don't know when did the event occur, okay? And that, so we need to, the key thing is that we need to have some kind of time reference, the time scale, time frame. And the time scale, usually, we take sequence divergence as an indication of the degree of divergence time, as a proxy of divergence time. And so the thing is that we ask whether the degree of divergence in expression between two duplicate genes is correlated with a degree of divergence in a sequence. And so if yes, then you can use a sequence divergence as an indication of divergence time. Yeah, okay, that's a good point. I'll come to that. Okay, so here is something for theoreticians to do, okay? So we want to see, to measure what's the divergence in expression between two genes. And a commonly used quantity is the correlation of expression levels of the two genes over different time points of an experiment or a process, okay? And I'll explain to you a little bit why expression correlation is not really a good quantity. But let's do that later. And here is some a study before our study. Wegener in 2000 did a study, and his study is that he, on one hand, he looked at the protein sequence divergence. On the other hand, he looked at the similarity in expression pattern. And you see a little bit of negative correlation, but the R square is small, okay? So you can explain the divergence very little from a protein sequence divergence. Okay, so that...
What is the how is the protein distance defined when they're far apart? Is this just for one family of proteins, or this is for?
No, you pairwise comparison between two proteins, okay, and you can make a Poisson correction, or you can do more sophisticated measurement of protein divergence.
But this is just one. In single protein family or with also very different families?
Different gene pairs, different protein pairs. So you at that time the data was not very abundant, okay? But let me explain. Okay, now I see what's the point, okay? What's the question, okay? So you have duplicate genes, right? You look at the duplicate genes. You take all the duplicate genes. And you have a different measurement of expression level or experimental time points, right? Okay, data points, and so you calculate correlation between of the two duplicate genes over different data points, right? Okay, and that you get a correlation. And the correlation indicates a similarity between the expression patterns of the two genes, right?
Okay.
So here he look at specifically two genes. Let me finish. Duplicate genes.
Okay.
East.
But some of them are divergent
of 0.9. Yeah. Let me explain. Okay. So you have one pair of duplicate genes. You get one R. You put it here. Okay. You get one point. Okay. You get the second pair. You get second point. You get third pair. And you have and each pair, you measure, you estimate the protein sequence divergence. You plot there. So you got one point in a figure. Okay. So every pair you get one point in a figure. So these dots are different pairs of proteins.
Expression pattern is time dependent, and in a single experiment, or is it pattern of expression under different conditions?
Okay, so for example, in cell cycle, you have 17 data points, and what that means is that in cell cycle, it synchronizes the cell, and then you start from time zero, and every 2 hours, you measure the expression level. You do a microarray, okay, and you get expression level, okay, and these are the first study didn't use so much, okay, and this is the data we use, okay. From Stanford, the database. Okay, and so in total you have 208 data points, and you can do correlation over that. Okay, and so you get every gene pair you did a correlation over all data points, so you get an R value, right? And you calculate the protein divergence, and you get a protein divergence value, and so you plot a point here. Okay, so every pair you get a point, and you can see that the data he used was a limit, very limited number of points. Okay, okay. So that's his study.
So what message you get? There's no
I see that there is no correlation between the expression and the
and
it's flat.
Yeah. Oh, a little bit of slope. Okay, but the it's not significant. Okay, you do a test, it's not significant. You have only 20 data points, and you have a R square of 0.09. So that means that you can explain the expression differences from the protein differences only 9% of the time. Okay, so you can explain very little. The correlation in expression from similarity in sequence. And now, do you understand? Is that okay? So by this, he concluded. So he concluded, protein sequence divergence and expression divergence are decoupled. That means there is no relationship between the protein sequence divergence and expression divergence. Okay, that's it, yeah. That's something interesting to theoreticians. Okay, so you have a protein database, and you want to know, which proteins are related to which protein, how you cluster proteins into different families. Okay, we did some study on that, and others do need that. But one very rough method is to use a BLAST. Okay, BLAST is that you do a very quick and dirty look at identical amino acids and to see if you get a region which would be beyond the statistical significance. Okay. No, it doesn't mean neutral. Why you cannot do protein sequence?
The point up on the top left.
Yeah.
The protein distance is 0.85.
As I say.
How do I know those are duplicate genes? The protein distance is
0.85. Protein distance of at 0.5, you know that protein don't. Protein sequence don't evolve uniformly. So you see a protein sequence and you have one stretch of, so you may have one stretch of good.
But I guess the question is, if these people, I don't see how you can do this unless you restrict yourself looking at mutations that you argue are neutral, because then there's no way that breaking distance can be regarded as a metric of
evolutionary power. Good point, and that's good point. Okay, so he said it's they are decoupled. Okay, but the point is it does not imply that expression divergence and evolutionary time are decoupled. And that's my point. That's because protein distance may not be a good proxy of divergence time. Yes. Yes. Okay. No. But in PNAS, okay.
Which
proceed in the National Academy of Sciences, okay. But actually, I would give him credit, okay, for asking the question, for carrying out the analysis, okay. And I'll come back. It's not totally unrelated. I'll show you, okay. Okay. So, as you say, you look at the protein distance, it may not be a good indication of divergence time, okay? That's because different proteins evolve at very different rates. And you cannot take one distance and say, okay, this applies to all protein pairs, okay? And so, but if you look okay. But if you look at the synonymous differences between genes, then they are closer to neutral changes, and they may represent divergence time better. Okay, and so we rely more on synonymous divergence. We did not ask Ks, and non-synonymous Ka. It's equivalent to protein distance. Okay, and we divide this on this, but nevertheless, you see that there's some correlation. Okay. And you ask how you detect duplicate genes. We develop a method which I don't go into, but in detail. Okay, but although you use a BLAST, you may use that's a quick and dirty, but sometimes that's a misleading. Why? Because you may have a protein domain shuffling. That you may have a protein domain in one gene, is transferred to another gene, and the two genes were originally not homologs, but because of this sharing of domain, they may be mistaken as related, okay? And that's one thing, okay? And there are other things involved, but that's not that's not the topic of today, okay? So, and the selection of duplicate genes, they are again another evolutionary consideration. So we want to select as many. We want to select independent data points, not correlated. So if one gene is already compared with another gene, we don't want to compare this gene with another gene. Okay. So we want to select each pair, independent pair. Okay. But because of the pairs with a smaller KS, it's a smaller, it's a few are fewer, and so we start with a smaller KS, and so that is, if you have only two genes in a duplicate genes, that's not a problem. But if you have a many in a gene family, and what we select is that we want to select a smaller divergence first, and then gradually larger divergence. Okay, and that's because in a database, there are fewer duplicate genes with a smaller divergence. Okay, and also that you know that when you talk about divergence time, if you have a K smaller, it reflects divergence time better. Okay, and also there are another thing that you consider, because East genes have many of them have a strong bias in codon usage. What does that mean is that you know, in some amino acid are encoded by four codons. Let's say proline is encoded by four codons. But if you look at the codons used, they are not even. Some codons are used much more often than the other, and that put some constraint on the codon usage. And by that, you may not have a uniform KS. Okay, KS. So we avoid such cases when you have a stronger bias in codon usage, then the KS is less likely to be linear with time. Okay, so there are such kind of evolutionary consideration. Okay, now so we selected 400 pairs from the East genome. Okay, and just a little bit of a transformation, because R is bounded by negative R and positive 1, negative 1 and positive 1. So we transform the sort of logistic transformation to amplify it to from minus infinity to plus infinity, so that we can do a normal regression more appropriate. Right, okay. And these were the data we used. So so in total, there are 208 data points. Okay, and so we did a regression over that. And here you can see that this is, okay. And KS, we don't talk, we don't take KS pairs beyond 1.5. That's because when it's large, it's very difficult to get accurate, reliable estimate of KS. So we exclude all this point, and you can see that there's a little bit of correlation. In fact, R is close to 50%, negative R, 50%, and it's highly significant, okay? So, one means that one means is that one substitution per site, per nucleotide site. Yeah, a little bit more complicated than Poisson. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You take care of multiple substitutions. That's what we run let's say S plus or something. You run a standard statistical package, and that's what you get.
Yes, but in what level can you reject the null hypothesis that there is no correlation?
Okay, you may have a p value very small, but if you look at R. R is close to 50%, not bad. In biology, if you get a 70% correlation, that's excellent correlation. Biological science and physical science are very, very different. In biology, if you have a theory which predict correctly 50% of time, you are very great. In physics, you are lousy. That's the difference. Okay. Yeah, that's true.
I'm sorry, it's not true. Can you give me an example of that? I would say the Hodgkin-Huxley theory for nerve conduction is correct all of the time. I would have thought
that. I should say in evolution, okay. So for example, in evolution, you make a prediction, you make some test, something, it's very rough.
Evolution,
you
know,
it's hard to go back. Yeah. Please then just say the biology is only 50% correct. Okay. So our value of 50% is not bad, okay? And even look, science published articles with a correlation coefficient of 24%. What can you say? I can show you many papers in science.
About what?
About correlation of 24%. Yeah.
Right. And I think one of the things that's very important in biology is to make a distinction between the two. That is, you can have situations where the statistical significance of some observation, because the number of data points is above, is 10 to the minus 20. Okay? But it can be true that the difference which generates that effect, significance is a difference of a few percent. In which case, knowing for an individual gene which value you observe is not predictive of whether it's one in one class or another. And I think for physicists interested in biology, it's very important to bear that distinction in mind. That is, that there are things where the correlations may be important, and they help us discriminate. involved. And there are other situations where you're trying to understand something and you want to make predictions, and there the correlation has to be strong enough so that predictions can be useful.
So there's also like the maybe things like this is a worse worry, which is if one uses a different model for how the sequences diverge and therefore a different sequence alignment algorithm, how different the answers could be. And that's what really needs to not do it in one way. But to even ask whether it's really statistically significant. I mean, if 3 × 10⁻⁵ really statistically significant, or is it that if you did it some other way, you would, which is just as reasonable, you would get something very different there. Now, in this case, I mean, I personally wouldn't argue very far because it seems that it would be unlikely that there wasn't some correlation here. If it went the other direction, almost presumably, find it rather surprising. But if it goes this direction,
Okay. Let's look at the complexity of biology, okay? So here, you look at the gene pairs, and you estimate the synonymous divergence. The synonymous divergence can, the synonymous divergence is a stochastic process. The stochastic process has a statistical variance in it. So the KS itself is not, it's different from developmental biology. You measure the level of expression, or you measure that, I don't know, like say a physiological reaction, you measure something, even physiological reaction maybe may have a lot of variation. But in the case of when you estimate KS, it has a big standard error there. Okay? So the KS is not something you can measure very accurately. Okay? So that's one introduction of errors there. The second thing is that you have so many different kinds of genes. And you are using a single measure to apply to all gene pairs, 400 gene pairs. Okay? That's a big assumption. That you assume the 400 pairs all evolve according to the same clock. How good can you expect that all of them follow the same clock? Okay? So you are dealing with a very chaotic system. If you see such kind of correlation, you should be happy, right? Because that's the difference between the evolutionary study and maybe some other type of study. Because there are so many things can get you wrong, okay? But you still observe 50% of correlation. That's a good correlation. I would say that's a good correlation. And if you look at the science, for example, less than a year ago, Science published a paper talking about the correlation between protein substitution rate and protein connectivity. And the correlation is 24%. Okay? And they conclude that protein connectivity is an important determinant of the rate of protein evolution. And if you look at the data, so many people were actually unhappy about the paper. You have some point that if you take just one or two points out, the correlation power becomes even worse. Okay, so in biology, you have to know that you are dealing with a very diverse world, not a very simple world. So in my experience, 50% correlation is a very good correlation. Okay, so now we say that now we look at this RKA and this protein sequence divergence, okay? So earlier we saw that there was no correlation between between a pattern of expression divergence and Ka. Now, if we cut off Ka at 30%, not the whole thing, okay? You cut off at 30% or 25%, we run a turning point analysis. It's not very sharp, it's about 30%, that's why you take 30%. You take 35%, you get a similar picture, 25%, you get. But the point is that if you limit to a smaller K divergence, you still see a correlation, 52% negative, 50%. And but beyond that, it's a flat none, very, very flat, okay? No correlation, okay? And that's what you started physics, so you know that a nonlinear physical process in the beginning, you can still approximate a process by a linear process. It holds for a while, right? And so even it's a very long linear, you look at the earlier stage, you can still see some correlation. Right? And as I say, Ka, you can, Ks, we cut off anything beyond 1.5 because that after that you cannot get very very reliable estimate. Okay. And but Ka you can get a more reliable estimate even when Ka is large. I mean here you still don't look at a very large Ka. Still look at 0.7%. 70%. Okay. And because Ka increase slower with time, so you have many more points in the figure. Ka is a long synonymous divergence. Ratio, you can look at the ratio, but as I say, when Ka is larger than 1.5, you can do that. Yes, you can do that. Yeah, we didn't do, but that can be done.
What's the reference of the clock for KS deviation? KS of 1 is how many? 100 million?
No one knows. but there are some. We have an estimate for. We have an estimate for Drosophila. Drosophila maybe 6 or 7 substitutions per billion years. Per billion years, 10^-9. Okay, so we also did the data. We look at what's the cDNA microarray. If I don't know if you know the microarray. There are two types of microarray. One is cDNA. Okay, cDNA is that you have a whole sequence. You put that on microchips. Okay, in your micro and the other is the alpha matrix data. Alpha matrix data use oligos, so maybe 25 mers. And the reason for using 25 mers is that you select regions where genes are different. And cDNA may cross hybridize because if the two genes are very similar and you put at the so then when you take RNA from a cell, when you run hybridize on the microarray, it may cross hybridize, okay? And so can give you different levels of expression, not real, okay? Alpha matrix data are better, but unfortunately, they have fewer data points, okay? But we did the same thing. And you see virtually identical correlations. That's what we, that because the data, so a little bit lower, but similar correlations, okay? So in conclusion, that a significant negative correlation between R and Ks. And also the expression divergence with a Ks and presumably with evolution time, okay? So expression divergence and evolution time are coupled, okay? The degree of divergence in expression does increase with a evolution time. And also in the initial stage, non-synonymous divergence and expression divergence are also correlated. Okay, and that's the traditional analysis. And I didn't like that kind of analysis because what? Because that it pool all data points together. Okay, and a potential problem may be this. You know, some genes are not involved in some of the process studied. So for example, a pair of genes may not be involved in cell division. And you run microarray on cell division, they won't respond in different time points, and you would get different correlation, okay? And so I think it's better to look at the individual process rather than to pool all data together. And this is what I say, okay? A gene pair may not be involved in a process. So now you come to the problem, the question of define what do you mean by expression divergence, okay? And initially we thought that if you look at the negative R's, negative correlations, and that would mean that the expression of the two genes are quite different, okay? And so if among the 14 process study, if we see one negative R, we may say, okay, that the two genes have diverged in expression. Or if we want to be more stringent, we may say, I see two negative R's, then I say that they are divergence. And that's a very, what heuristic argument, okay? And again, so then my student Zeng Long did a moving window analysis, and so you make a window size, Ks is larger and Ks is smaller, and you plot so this means the proportion. So if we say if one negative R, then we say that the two genes have divergent expression, and then here is a proportion of the genes in the window, inside the window that have divergent expression, and this is a Ks divergence. And so you can see that even in the beginning, it's over 60%, and it goes up to about one, close to one, okay, as time goes on, as the Ks increase. And if you say that's not a very stringent, you may say, okay, if two negative R's, then I say the two genes have diverged in expression, and it goes up, you see, okay? Also that in the beginning, it's close to 50%. So by that, we can say, okay, when you look at Ka, because it increase with time slower, and they increase earlier, and it's over 60% or 50% in the beginning, okay? So, no, let's say sporulation, all that sporulation is one process, cell division is one process, and here we don't look at the correlation here. Oh yeah, we look at the correlation for just within all the data points within one process. I mean, actually, experiment, one experiment. Yeah. In the case of sporulation, you don't do perturbation or cell cycle. You may do synchronization. The cell cycle, you synchronize them because otherwise you don't know how to measure them. Okay. Sporulation, you don't do anything. So some of the process you don't do, and some of the process you do starvation or you add some chemicals or something. Okay. And so, okay. And so, this already what I explained in a figure. So that's one way to analyze the data. Okay. And you can see that you would accept my definition of expression divergence, then you can see that defect genes diverge very, very quickly. And so the two questions, how fast and how often are answered. The majority, almost all defect genes eventually become diverged in expression. And how fast? They may occur very fast. Even if you look at very small divergence, they already have a lot of pairs that have diverged in expression. Okay, that analysis may not, the statisticians may not like that kind of analysis because that microarray data may be messy, and by chance you may have a negative correlation. I don't know. Okay, so we did another analysis. So suppose if the true correlation is a 50%, or smaller, then we say the two genes have diverged in expression. Okay, in the literature, people commonly take 70% of correlation as or higher as co-expressed. People may take 80% or 90%. But say we say we take 50% of correlation or this as divergence, then then the question is that how do you know that one observation is really below 50%? Okay, and that requires statistics. Okay. Most different genes. No, these have survived.
But how do you know
the common observation is that when they diverge to some extent, then they have the advantage to be maintained in a genome. Our question is how often and how fast. We don't predict whether this gene is going to be a pseudo gene or it's going to be there forever. So the question is just to see if they have diverged or have not diverged. That's a different question. Our question here is that how quick two typical genes would diverge in expression. And we use all the well-defined. So people have some indication that these genes are real genes, not pseudo genes, or not by prediction, just by rely on. You know, they not all the ORFs in East have been proved to have function or are real, but So we exclude those don't have experimental data support. Yeah. Yeah. That's a very important difference between East genome and, let's say, human genome. Or some, like human genome, you see many pseudo genes, but in East genome, you don't see many pseudo genes. In bacteria genome, you also don't see many pseudo genes because they probably have some way to streamline the genome. So now here is a statistical question, okay? So suppose the true value of the correlation between two genes is 50%. And now you have, you have an observation, you have a data and you calculate an R. So I use the distinguishing rho as the true value, okay? R as the observed value, estimated value. And so you have an observed value and you want to know, is it significantly smaller than 50%, okay? And this, and okay, another thing that may not be very good is that in our early analysis, we include that processes that have very few data points, and that may not be good for calculating correlations, okay? And so now we take a more stringent condition. We use only processes that have at least 9 data points, okay? And so we want to see whether that calculated R value is significantly smaller than 0.5, okay? So there are 9 processes that have at least 8 data points, not 9, at least 8 data point or more, okay? And then for each process, we calculate the R value. And then what we did was to say, okay, instead of looking at the whether the R value, an individual R value, and so we look at the smallest, the two smallest R value, and ask the question, if the true correlation is 50%, and you observe 9 times, you do the experiment 9 times, what is the probability that you would observe such a small R value, two or the smallest R value? So for example, you may observe a R value of 0 and a R value of minus 0.5. And then you ask the question, what is the is this the probability of observing such a 2R value less than 5%? If it's less than 5%, then we say, okay, it's truly smaller than 50%. Okay, and it's significant less than 50%. Okay, so we consider doing a bootstrap. And the bootstrapping is to first, I don't like parametric bootstrapping because you assume some kind of distribution, okay? But we thought about doing non-parametric bootstrapping. If you have one single observation and you want to know if it's smaller than a certain value, significant than certain value, then it's very easy to do non-parametric bootstrapping because you just do the bootstrapping and see what is the number of times that you proportion that you observe the value smaller than a particular value, okay? But two, if you have two process or more, then I did not know how to do the non-parametric bootstrapping, okay? We tried quite a few alternatives, but did not work. So we finally did parametric bootstrapping. And this is to say, okay, for each process, we bootstrap a sample with n pseudo data point. So we have 9 processes. And each process, you have we have a data point, okay? So for a process which has 8 data points, then our n is 8, okay? And we have, because we're looking at the two variables, we want the two smallest observations, so we look at two variables, and so we assume a bivariate normal distribution. And with the mean and variance, so this mean and variance covariance matrix are estimate from the data points, okay? And then from this, we compute the correlation coefficient from the bootstrap sample. And the theoretical basis is this, okay? So we repeat that the bootstrap is that you repeat a number of times, like say b times, and each time you get the r value. And the empirical distribution of this is used to, so you simulate the process and you get the r correlation for a large enough number of times, say b, and you get this. And then use this to approximate distribution of r. In particular, so what you say is that, okay, I have this true value and I have this many data points. And what's the probability that I would observe a correlation smaller than the threshold, the critical value I'm looking at, okay? And this is just a notation. And this is the bootstrapping. This is the indicator function. And if the pseudo sample, if a pseudo sample is smaller than this, then I give it a 1. If it's if it doesn't fit this condition, then it's 0, okay? And B is a total number, so this is in fact the proportion of the bootstrapping, bootstrap pseudo samples that is smaller than this critical value, okay? And so suppose that's one process. Now suppose we have n process are studied and they are n subject, okay, for pairs observations for each process. And so you have n process, so j runs from 1 to m, okay? And from the above approximation, we can evaluate the probability. This is for a j process, What is the probability? We observe that. And then you calculate the permutations, okay, the probability so that you have at least one. So we have two values, because we have two R's. And so we observe one R smaller than this, another R smaller than this, given this true value and this many process. And this can be used to from the previous calculation. That you have no observation that is smaller than this, this is smaller than this, okay? You have no, or you have only one in between, okay? And so you can deduct this probability, and then you come to, okay. So you can make a calculation, and this table is to show you in relation, if I just look at the negative number, number of negative R's, what's the relationship between the more rigorous calculation and the intuitive argument. So if I have, so we classify the R values into no zero, okay? None of the observed R is smaller than zero. Number is zero, okay? Let's see. Oh, so no pair has a negative R value, and this is one negative R value, two negative R value, and three or more. And there are 43 pairs that have no negative R value, and none of them, regardless of the devil, if you say true value is 50% or 60%, you have no case that is significant. And if you have one negative R value, okay, I'll be finished in a few minutes. And then there are 66%, and you have 25 pairs, there are 66 pairs, and you have 25 pairs, that is significant with this definition, okay? And that's about 38%. If you make a less stringent, you have a higher value, but let's not look at that value. And if you have, say, two negative R, you have 70%, and you have a 61 pair, that is significant. So you have 87%. So by this, we see that in order to for an observed pair of a smallest R value to be significant, at least you need to have a negative R value, okay? And even for two negative R value, it's not 100% that it's significant. And so I think the more rigorous analysis is somewhat more stringent than the earlier one. But still, you can see that the proportional gene pair with expression divergence is that even if you have a very small degree of Ka, that's less than 10%, you still see 43% of the pairs that have diverged, and this goes up with time, okay? And the Ka increases more slowly, and so you see a higher value, okay? So again, you come to the conclusion that the duplicate genes diverge quite quickly in expression, and if you wait long enough, the vast majority of them will diverge in function. Okay, so this is these are the conclusions we made, okay? And that's, anyway, I'm able to finish only the first talk, okay? The second talk, you can see, just appear in January 2nd in Nature, and which is deals with a different issue. That people have been puzzled that previously people thought that if you want to know a gene function, maybe you knock out a gene and you see what's the phenotypic effect. But people were puzzled that you knock out a gene, you don't see any phenotypic effect, and what's the reason? And there are two mechanisms possible for this. One is that you have alternative pathways. You have an alternative network that can back up. and the other is that you have duplicate genes, and duplicate genes, you delete one copy, the other can still function, okay? And the current view, before we did that, the study was that duplicate genes play a very, very minor role, okay? And we did this study, we say it may not be true, okay? Duplicate gene may play up to 50% or so in genetic robustness against null mutations. Okay, that concludes my talk, okay? Thank you for your attention. Yeah. The duplication issue is that way. The first duplication is usually more difficult because duplication is usually from an unequal crossover. So you have an out-registry recombination. So you have a one gene here, and you have a original one gene, but a recombined out-registry. And so from this, you have a one chromosome with two genes. You have one chromosome with no gene, and this kind of recombination is rare. But once you have a duplication, then it accelerates.
Is the rate of it known?
Huh?
Is the rate of it known in any context?
No. We did some. We estimate in human genome or East genome, it may be maybe 0.1 or 0.01 duplication per million years or something. Per gene per million year, okay? So in a genome, per million year, you may have a couple of duplications. Yeah?
But is there evidence that most duplications arise with the two dots initially close to each other as opposed to
complicated? No. And this is just a suggested mechanism. And this one copy, okay? Original one, this is only one copy. But for some reason, if you have a recombination here, then one chromosome inherits two copies, one has none. Okay? And once you have a duplication, then duplication can occur more frequently, more easily, because now you have a outer registry pairing, right? These two are highly homologous, and they can pair, okay? And so if you have a recombination here, then you can have one with three copies, one with no copies, or one copy, okay? This one would result. Okay, so duplication in the beginning is regarded to be at a very low rate, the first duplication. Yeah, tandem duplication. Yeah. But so here, this is excised. This is, okay. So it's a reciprocal, okay. But if this happens to be fixed, then you have three copies. Or if this contribute more dosage and happens to be advantageous, so for example, you look at histone genes, or you look at ribosome RNA genes, they have many. That because it requires a lot for a translation machinery. I'm not familiar with that. He may explain to us. I'm not familiar with. I'm a mathematician by training. I don't know I don't know very much about biology. Yes, but we want to take independent pairs, and so the when you have a three copies, that two of them will duplicate at the same time, we take only one pair. We exclude the third copy.
Why?
That's because we want to take independent data points. Yes, but it complicates your analysis.
Yeah.
And because you have to deal with correlations, right? Your data are correlated. When your data are correlated, your analysis may not be straightforward. And so we try to take independent pairs. We don't want pairs to be related. So you see my point? Yeah, sure.
So they appear to be very broken, right?
Yeah. Sure. But if you want to do a more detailed analysis, that's fine. It complicates your analysis. And no problem. Okay.
I think more closer into the region of the
gene. No. No, that's the next step we want to do. That's good case. Oh, same question. Okay. Yeah. Okay, thank you.